So won't you please join me in welcoming Penn Jillette.
Me to do that. It's kind of embarrassing, but they want the picture in front of the green. Thanks so much. Thank you. This is the first one of these shindigs I'm doing, so I haven't really got my whole shtick down. So you're going to get a little more of the really what's popping into my head. I'm going to mostly have you ask any questions you want on anything, you know, that I know about. So stay away from sports. But I want to talk about my new book, which is Every Day is an Atheist Holiday. You know, the last book, God No, started out with Glenn Beck. It started out with me talking to Glenn Beck and becoming friends with Glenn Beck and wanting to answer some of the questions he brought up to me, you know, being very, very odd friends, you know, with him being a, you know, with Glenn Beck being a Mormon and me being a graduate of Kyle College, it's very clear we're both wearing funny underwear, but for different reasons. And then this book kind of started with Piers Morgan. What a Piers Morgan show. I'd never been on before. And for those of you who don't know Piers Morgan personally, my good friend Stephen Fry over in England, a brilliant man, was on a television show, was talking about word meanings and derivations. And Stephen Fry said that the word countryside meant the killing of Piers Morgan. You know, countryside. The killing of Piers Morgan. So so that's the kind of guy Piers is. So I was on his show, and he started out the show, before we went on, talking about how much fun I was going to have on Celebrity Apprentice, a lie, and how happy he was to have me there, another lie. And he started the interview by saying something essentially like, I don't like you and I don't like your book. And then it went downhill from there. And one of the things he did in trying to rattle me as an atheist was he talked about fear of death and then hit what I thought was a little bit below the belt by talking about my mom. And I'm a real mama's boy. If you wonder about the red fingernail, I wear the red fingernail because it's my mom's nail polish, or my mom's nail polish and my dad's ring. I was very close to my parents. And he said, you know, doesn't it hurt you that there'll be no afterlife, you don't believe in an afterlife, and that you'll never see your dead mother again? It's really nice when you're on live television and someone is talking about your dead mother. But that's the kind of guy he's. So we're talking about that, and I just said to him, I got kind of an inspiration. And he said, you know, how afraid of you are of death? You know, how much does it hurt you that you won't be around in the future? And I said, 1909. How much does 1909 scare you? And he didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, no, 1909, you weren't around. In 1909, for all intents and purposes, you were dead. In 1909, that's the year my mom was born. But 1909 to you, Piers, is exactly like 2109. You won't be here. And it's just not that frightening. It's just kind of okay. You have won the biggest lottery you could ever win in the universe. You are here, as Richard Dawkins has said many times. You are here. The chances of any one of us being here and alive and seeing this wonderful world are so close to zero, it almost doesn't matter. But we've made it. We've already won. And the idea that you could have things like my mom's orange Jell-O and sunsets and love and each other and art and beauty and truth and all these things we have around us all the time and love, and then have the lack of grace to ask for more. Then you want more. Then you want an afterlife. Then you want all this stuff beyond that. And I thought about November 11th, 1909, the day my mom was born. If you're having trouble doing the mathematics, my mom was 45 when I was born, and I'm now 57. So it does work out. My mom was born way back in 1909. And I think about that date and how important that date is to me, even though I wasn't alive then. And from there, kind of, hello.
Are you alive?
It's very funny that of everybody in this room, the child chose to approach me. Clearly the least scary and gentlest person in the room. So that gave me the idea that holidays, holy days, are every day. Every single day is an atheist holiday. And although everybody has said this in the arts, it's really important to enjoy and love every day. And being an atheist and not believing in an afterlife doesn't take away from that joy, but makes every moment of that joy more precious. So I go through, and from that kind of idea about truth and beauty, I then talk about many, many stories, like fucking a turkey on Thanksgiving, which a friend of mine did. And for those of you who liked from the last book, me dropping my dick in a blow dryer, we have all the skin coming off my balls after being stung 25 times by bees naked in front of people right here in New York City, as a matter of fact. And there's a lot of stories like that. And I also talk about a lot about Celebrity Apprentice. And I tell a very long story about Clay Aiken, who was Clay Aiken over that time. And I also talk about Donald Trump, who I want to say, there's been a lot of controversy about Donald Trump. But the one thing I do want to say is I'm the guy who did the show Bullshit, and I have been this close. I want to get a picture of me doing this gesture on stage. This close to Donald Trump's head, and he is not wearing a toupee. He does not wear a toupee. But his hair does look exactly like cotton candy made of piss. But he is not wearing a toupee. So I've been doing, as I'm here, I've been sequestered in New York City doing the Celebrity Apprentice All-Stars. And there's certain things I cannot comment on from there, but there's other stuff that I can comment on. Anything you want to know about every day as an atheist holiday, or anything you want to know about anything. I started doing interviews this morning on Fox and Friends, and then I went to Opie and Anthony, then I did 2.5 hours on Sirius doing other stuff, then I did The Big Think, and I am all wound up and ready to talk about anything. So I'm also going to be doing, after this, I'll be doing my good buddy Greg Gutfeld's show, Red Eye, and then I'll go right over to do LOD's show with Lawrence O'Donnell Jr., who has a show over on MSNBC. I may be the only person who goes directly from Fox News to MSNBC on one thing, but they're both friends of mine. And LOD, Lawrence O'Donnell Jr., is also represented heavily in the book. One time when LOD and I decided to stop swearing completely, which is really fucking hard for both of us. And the other place he's represented is when I was blackmailed. Just last year, I was blackmailed, worked with the FBI, did everything I could to keep it completely quiet, and then wrote a chapter about it and put it out in a book that I'm trying to make very successful. So I'm a man of complicated motives. But if there's any question or anything, just stick your hand up and I will answer it. Probably in a very long, no one has any questions. Sir, in the back with white.
I gotta try. How do you do the bullet in mouth?
We do a bullet catch in Vegas, and the bullet catch is a really interesting trick. It is a trick. There is a book out, and I'm supposed to only push my own book, but this other book is really hard to get, so fine. There's a book called 12 Have Died, which describes how 12, and it's now up to about 14 people, have died doing the bullet catch. The bullet catch is the trick that Chung Ling Soo died on stage doing at the London Palladium in the early part of the 20th century. The bullet catch essentially goes like this. You get someone up from the audience, they sign a bullet, it's loaded into a gun, it's shot across the stage, and the magician catches it in his hand or in his teeth, lately usually in his teeth. And it is a trick developed. It's a pure American trick, and although this is going to seem like a very sick joke, it's not. It was developed by Native American magicians, who, as their act, would ask the people from England to shoot guns at them, which turned out badly, but and they would catch the bullet in their hands. It's a conjuring trick. It's what we call a swindle or a ripoff. And Teller and I do a two-person version where the guns are loaded, bullets are loaded in 357 magnums, two of them, and then shot across the stage, and we catch them ostensibly in our teeth. It's a trick. Now, we worked about 3 years on developing this trick, and some of the technology for it is very, very involved. But what I find so interesting about it is Chung Ling Soo had the audience member take the bullet, loaded the gun, and shot him. Now, he was using a method for this where he had two barrels of the gun, essentially side by side. He was using a muzzle-loading gun that he would tamp down. And he would put the powder in one chamber and then sneak the bullet out, have a fake bullet in, and just be firing right across the chamber, a safe weapon, our audience member would be. And he had been doing the trick a long time, and the gun had gotten fatigued, and a piece of metal had broken off, got into there, and he was shot in the face by a piece of metal on stage at the London Palladium in front of a sold-out house. And I've always wondered if after that show, the police came in and said to the guy who fired the gun, okay, let me get this straight. Walked up on stage, in front of 3,000 people, you signed a bullet, loaded to a gun, pointed to the man's face, pulled the trigger, shot him in the face, he's dead. Is that right? Yes. Okay, you can go. But if you have any questions later. The other guy, this is the one I'm most afraid of. There was a magician called Willard, the Wizard of the West, who was a snake oil salesman, essentially, who would sell, you know, health products, and then end his show by catching a bullet in his teeth. And Willard of the West was a very, very careful magician and believed he had a very, very safe method. He was on stage, and the bullet catch came at the end of his act. He was about 15 minutes into his act, and a person stood up in the audience and said, "Catch this," and shot him in the face. Another magician who died doing this was a magician who had a great method where he would take the bullet, which is a muzzle loader once again. This is a magician in the late 19th century. Take a bullet, have it signed, and then he would put it into the gun and then tamp it down. And he would tamp it down with his wand, which is kind of a nice little moment, right? He takes the gunpowder and pours it in, and then takes the bullet that's signed and puts it in, and then takes his wand and tamps it. And his method was a really, really smart method. He had a black wand with ivory tips, and on the end of the ivory tip, he had a little piece of magician's wax. Now, magician's wax is wax. And it was stuck on the end of the wax, and he slid that wand into there. It would stick onto the bullet. And the nice thing is, he would then pull it out, turn it around, so he could feel the bullet in his hand. He could feel the bullet right there. So he has the slug in his fingers. It's already signed that he's then going to slip into his mouth. It's really a safe method, man. That looks really, really good on paper, right? And then, when he flipped the wand around and was holding it here, he would then take the other end of the wand and do one more little tamp down. And then when he pulled it out that time, you could see that the wand had nothing on it. It's a very good method, very, very smart. One night, he pushed the wand in, and unbeknownst to him, the ivory tip of his wand came off in the barrel. He brought it out, showed it, loaded the bullet into his mouth, and got shot in the face and killed with the ivory tip of his very own wand. So that's how three of the people who did this trick have died. And Teller and I have been doing a version where we shoot through glass panes and then catch it in our teeth and then examine it. It's the same thing. And our method is different than those. Next question.
I've been out to Las Vegas a lot. I've seen a lot of shows, and your show is simply the best in Las Vegas. So I'm going to say that. As accomplished as you are, and as brilliant a show as that is, how difficult was it for you to do Dancing with the Stars and then that idiot Trump show?
You know, part of my job, I really do the Penn and Teller show for free. I mean, that's just a joy from beginning to end. All I've ever wanted in my life wants to do a show like the Penn and Teller show and work with someone as brilliant as Teller. It's the best part of my life, and it is my life, and I love it. And I'm from a small town in Massachusetts, and the first person I met in show business was me. You know, there was nobody I ever knew that did that. Being able to do that is a dream come true. Part of doing my show in Vegas and part of writing books, which I love doing, is selling the show in Vegas and having people learn about it. So I went on Dancing with the Stars, and I learned something, and please forgive me. I was the first one thrown off Dancing with the Stars, and I certainly should have been thrown off Dancing with the Stars. They did not like me. They thought I moved like a crippled elk. But no one danced with more joy than me. And on top of that, I didn't know this about dance. And I think this has to do with the difference between the speed of light and the speed of sound. Dancers do not care about where the beat is. It's astonishing. I'm a bass player. I play upright bass. I play bebop jazz. And I play electric bass. And the pocket is all that matters on music, certainly on bebop jazz. You gotta have that pocket. And when they measure Ray Charles, his snaps and songs, he's within milliseconds of where he should be. To just carry a beat like that with no variation is really, really difficult. That's what makes music so beautiful. So we went into Dancing with the Stars. We were doing our rehearsals, and Kim Johnson, who's my partner, was fabulous and wonderful, and they let her be my partner because she was the only one of the partners that wasn't a Christian. So they thought they'd give me a chance. And we would talk about it, and she didn't care at all about where the beat was. And I was watching the other celebrities rehearsing on Dancing with the Stars, and they were just not on the beat. Even the ones that did the best were not exactly on the beat. And I could not understand that. I was just going, wow, we've got this. None of the rest of them know where the beat is. They're kind of moving beautifully. They look gorgeous. Every line is great. But shouldn't their foot go on one? Wouldn't that be really important? And then we got up there and we danced exactly in beat and we were completely thrown off. And then I went, probably a little bit too late, and watched some video of ballroom dancers and other kind of dancers on YouTube. And I found out, I noticed that they're also out of time. Your best dancers are often a little bit out of time compared to a real jazz musician. I mean, compared to Ray Brown playing bass or Oscar Peterson or Mingus or somebody. They're a little bit out of time, but your mind adjusts and put it together. So on Dancing with the Stars, the really important thing on that show was not to look like a big ugly son of a bitch with a square head stumbling around the stage. But I did hit every beat perfectly. As far as Trump's show is really interesting because whatever opinion you have of Donald Trump, the show is run really honestly. A lot of people think there's manipulation of the situation, that people are brought their lunches late and made crazy. And it's really not that. I didn't really understand it until I read Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, where he talks about ego depletion. And the fascinating thing about what I learned from the ego depletion chapter in Thinking Fast and Slow is that if you put cameras on people for 2 or 3 hours, they're very, very careful what they say, and they do a very, very good job. If you keep cameras on them for about 8 to 10 hours, their ego becomes depleted and they have no control. And that's why really nice people end up squabbling and screaming and bickering on that show. But, that show and Dancing with the Stars did sell tickets to the Penn and Teller show in Vegas. And, I want to do a great show, but I also want people to see it. So I go on those shows and I enjoy them while I'm doing them, even though it's not what I really do. What I really like to do is do the show and write books. I'm actually happiest when I'm writing. Should I finish up, Glenn, or take one more question? A couple more questions. Yes, sir.
I absolutely adored your eloquent take on the big think of the Republican primaries. Amazing. I thought you might be able to elaborate on it since post-election.
You know, it's interesting that I think we're going to see things changing really heavily because there's another book but that talks about the word Christian and how the word Christian came into our vocabulary. Now, obviously, Christian goes way back, but used as a political force, Christian really does start up about the time the anti-abortion movement starts up. It starts up late 60s, 70s is when it starts up, and really doesn't hit it until Jimmy Carter is president. Because before that, like the late 19th century, you had Robert Ingersoll, who was the really great atheist at the time, Mark Twain, and you had Huxley, who were all traveling around the United States doing lectures mostly on atheism. They were very, very popular. And atheist was not a bad word until it got associated with the socialists in the early part of the 20th century. But in the late part of the 20th century, they came up with this word Christian. And the word Christian was magic. Because before that, Catholics and Baptists and Southern Baptists and Bob's Bait Shop and Baptists and Methodists were all considered totally separate sects. And if you break them down into separate religions, atheists have a really good chance of being heard. But then they come up with this Christian thing and had this really powerful take. So people who are just completely crazy, like Michelle Bachmann and people like that, you know, Sarah Palin, and even Obama with his crazy church in Chicago, you know, all of these people are parts of religions that are very, very small groups, very small groups. But then they automatically and magically use this word Christian and got this big blanket, and that's what all the Christian nation garbage starts coming in and all of that. And what's happening now is really, really crazy because atheists are getting numbers. There's a lot of polls out there. I don't want to quote one that's wrong. But people with no religion, which is slightly different from atheists, I don't want to misrepresent, but people with no religion are around 20% of the country now, which makes, well, if you call atheist a religion, which is like calling not collecting stamps a hobby, if you call atheist a religion, it's the fastest growing religion in American history. And so I'm hoping that the same people who bundled together the Baptists and the Catholics and the Methodists and the Congregationalists, people that bundled all of them together and called them Christians, will have to continue for political reasons to broaden even further and maybe get to calling everyone Americans and maybe the step beyond that and calling people people. I'm hoping that that trend of the Christians being inclusive keeps going until it includes me. So that's all. That's what I'm going for on that. And I won't go through the individual people because they're all gone now. But please remember that Obama has said he is Christian, and he says that all the time. And I know you're doing that like you have a secret deal with him. Has he said something different to you?
No, but
so he's either Christian or he's a liar, and I'd rather go with Christian until the Benghazi thing comes out. Yes.
I saw a...
Mi parolis Esperanto.
I saw your video clip about the language Esperanto. Thank you for speaking in Esperanto. And I want you to say a few words on that and how you perceive international relations in the future and interreligious relations in the future.
Well, he's talking about Esperanto, which is, we all know, William Shatner did a movie in. It's the international language. It's a real whack job thing that I absolutely love and studied. And the thing is that I think technology took over. I mean, the translation software is getting so phenomenal that we really are. I mean, our solution to everything ends up being technology. I mean, I know I keep quoting other people's books and watching the people from Penguin there wince, but Steven Pinker's book about the angels, the Better Angels book about violence is going down is just incredible. I mean, the world really is getting better, and everybody really is getting happier, and there really is more love and peace and lack of violence all over the place. And, wow, watch this. Just watch this. Watch professional work. And I think that's because every day is an atheist holiday. I think I'm going to vomit. You want to do?
We got one more question because you don't get that.
Yeah, I got to go do Red Eye. But yeah, let's take a question for you.
I was going to ask, Chris, was he in the Bible series, one of the great atheists of our generation? Was he an influence on you at all?
Christopher Hitchens was my hero and my friend. There's a whole chapter in here about two very good friends of mine, Christopher Hitchens and Tommy Arnolino, who died very close to the same time and who I loved dearly. And Hitchens... You know, when I would do one of those pundit talking head shows with Hitchens, even if I disagreed with Hitch on the whole subject, I would find something he said to agree with just so he would not rip me a new asshole. I had an experience with Hitchens that, it's not really much of a story, but it means the world to me. I did a movie called The Aristocrats, as you mentioned, and... I had just finished up close to a final cut, and it was just at my house. It was no place else. We had about another 3 or 4 months and fix up sound and all of that. I did the sound of the movie myself. I actually hooked up the mic, and I actually ran the sound and put the headphones on and everything. So the movie cost $80,000 to make and then $250,000 to fix my sound mistakes. So we had it at my house, which is called the Slammer, because it's built kind of like a prison. And I invited, it was the Skeptics Conference was in town in Vegas, and I invited a bunch of people over to watch a first cut of it. And I asked Hitch if he wanted to come over. And I have never had a drink of alcohol in my life, and I've never had a recreational drug in my life. And although when you travel through the world as a teetotaler, you're surrounded by people who are drinking all the time, as soon as I got out of high school, I was so sick of people being drunk and stoned all the time that I kind of promised myself that I would always have a house that had no alcohol and no dope in it at all. So my house, the Slammer, had never had any alcohol inside it. And Hitchens, as we all know, was very fond of drinking and drank a lot. And I never saw him drink so much that he still wasn't the most most articulate person, not just in the room, but in the whole country. And Hitchens walked up to my door, and he was carrying a bottle of liquor, a full bottle of liquor. And I said, I really don't like having alcohol in my house. And Hitchens said to me, "So you want me to respect your religion?" And I said, "Well, it's not really religious." And he said, "Yes, it is." And it was the evening. We were going to do the screening at about 10 or 11 at night. It was about 9:30. And there I am in Vegas night in the desert looking at Christopher Hitchens. And I said to him, "I'd really like it if you didn't... he didn't bring the liquor into my house." And Hitchens said, "Are you going to stop me?" And we paused for a long time, and we looked at each other, and I said, "I don't know." And he said, "What do you mean you don't know?" And I said, "I don't know." And then we stood there looking at each other, and I knew that I was outgunned 1,000,000 to 1 if we got into an argument. And I also knew, even though my size, I was outgunned even if it got physical, because I've never hit anybody in my life. All I've ever done is fall down and bleed. That's my system of defense. And Hitch and I stood there in the Vegas moonlight in the desert with him with a bottle of liquor and me with a dirty movie. And we stood there, and Hitchens just took the bottle after a very long time. And by a long time, I mean like probably a minute and a half of just silence with two people who talk a wicked lot, just looking at each other and thinking about what was going to happen. And then in a moment that, and I realize this is such a strange story to tell, it's not really a story, but it still makes me cry, Hitchens just took the bottle of liquor and placed it right down on the porch, right in the center of the walkway, in the center of the sidewalk. I mean, no sense of to one side or over on a railing or anything. He just put it down and said, let's watch a movie. And we walked in together, and that moment of all the hours, and not enough hours, but still hours of conversations I had with Hitchens, that was the moment that there was some sort of understanding, because in no way did he compromise. In no way did he back down. In no way did I win. He just did this with respect and dignity, and he was just one of the most wonderful men I've ever met, certainly one of the greatest writers who ever lived, and I miss him every second. When I was working on this book, I would have a question about some derivation that couldn't be found just right there on the web and couldn't be just Googled. And I would actually start an email to Hitch, you know, that horrible thing you do after people die and just have my heart broken. So, yes, Hitchens was a hero, and Hitchens was a friend, and Hitchens was the best of us, and I'll miss him every second. And shall I, if anybody would like to have a book signed, I don't want to.